And you know, as we talk about the solar observer and the sun, of course, it reminds me of what Ed Dame said years ago on this program, and that was his kill shot that he tied into the space shuttle being forced down by a meteor shower. And then he said the sun is going to set some flares off that would do some horrendous things to us. I don't know. But let me tell you something. Our science advisor and head of the EnterpriseMission.com is Richard C. Hoagland, and he's with us for a full 2 hours tonight as we talk about the space shuttle and some other fascinating things that Richard has uncovered. Richard, it's just what? When do we have a landing here?
We have a landing at about 5:56 Eastern time, which is 3 hours earlier your time, so about an hour after we go off the air. But they're going to do the burn over the Indian Ocean in the last 8 minutes of the show, so I'll be able to narrate the burn live.
Oh, that's perfect. That's perfect. Now, let's keep our fingers crossed. This being the anniversary, the 42nd anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, can you believe it's been 42 years already?
No, someone was saying on my Facebook page this afternoon that it's been 42 years. And to me, I mean, it's like crystal clear. I can remember almost everything like it was yesterday. It's just what I'm really upset about, and obviously a lot of other people are too, is what have we done in the last 42 years that's commensurate with Kennedy's vision? You know, we've been marking time. I know for a lot of people, the last flight of Atlantis this evening or this morning, the end of the 30-year space shuttle, represents the end of NASA. I mean, they're looking at it in almost cataclysmic terms. To me, it clears the decks for a new beginning. It moves away a technology which is 30-plus years old, actually more like 40, because the shuttle was based on technology already about 10 years old when it was designed. And it's been going around and around and around and around in Earth orbit, going basically nowhere for 30 years. We're now poised on the brink, as you're going to hear in the next couple of hours, of some extraordinary, stunning possibilities. And we had to move that shuttle out of the way because we as a culture, George, do not value space. And with all the discussions of money and debt ceilings and fiscal crises and governments too big, I mean, NASA is like 0.6 cents for every federal dollar. If you take a dollar, that represents the annual federal budget, NASA is not even a penny of that $1. And yet we cannot do the things we need to do to move beyond low Earth orbit with that minuscule amount of money. And so as long as the shuttle was sucking up money and time and talent and engineering and computers and NASA employees and contractors and all that, we couldn't do anything else. Finally, now, tonight, the old is being put to rest, and the new is about to be born.
I hope the new is born, though, Richard.
Well, at the end of the 2 hours, you'll see why it basically has got to.
It has to.
We ain't got no other possibilities.
That's true. Yesterday, my guest, Charles Seif, was not too happy with NASA, and specifically said the shuttle program wasn't worth it at all. Would you agree with that?
What was that last part? Like, he said
the shuttle program wasn't worth it at all.
Well, I don't agree with that, because the next step, which we did not do with Apollo, when the Apollo program closed in 1972 in December with the last mission, Apollo 17, NASA basically threw everything it had learned in Apollo away and started over. I mean, that's not very economical and very perspicacious or wise or penny wise. And we are not going to do that this time. We are going to be taking, as you're going to hear later on this morning, major components of the space shuttle system, which is technically called the space transportation system, which includes that big, huge orange tank, which holds 500,000 gallons of fuel, the two solid rocket boosters they strap on both sides, and the orbiter they hung off the side. And except for the orbiter, the other three components are going to be reconfigured according to a plan that I discussed here years ago called DIRECT, a shuttle-derived heavy lift launch vehicle, and is supposed to be ready by 2016 to send astronauts to the moon. And it's only possible to do it on that rapid a pace because we're reusing huge technological engineering components of the expertise and hard-won lessons that the shuttle has given us over the last 30 years. Plus, of course, we got a space station in the bargain. Now, I heard Charles also kind of kibitzing about the station. Oh, it's not this, it's not that, it's doing high school science. Well,
right.
He has an extremely jaundiced view. If you go back and you look, George, at the early visions of people like von Braun, you go back and you read the books, you read them, the Collier's articles that Chesley Bonstell illustrated so brilliantly before the dawn of the real space age. Everyone always talked about the need, if we're going to go anywhere else in the solar system with chemical propulsion, to assemble structures in Earth orbit. We have spent the last 30 years figuring out how to economically and incredibly safely assemble very large structures in Earth orbit, which is going to be imperative if we're going to take men and women and send them to asteroids or Mars or, you know, the moons of Jupiter or even go back to the moon. You cannot do it in a single launch from Earth. You must assemble in Earth orbit. So it's interesting that the last mission of the space shuttle program is kind of like a little buy-in to part of von Braun's vision, part of von Braun's dream, because in order to do all this in Earth orbit, you also have to learn the technique of zero gravity refueling.
Absolutely. It is amazing when you think of it, the technology involved in the simplicity of being able to assemble these things.
Well, it makes it look easy, but it's been incredibly hard. The astronauts used to talk in Houston about the what they called the wall of EVA.
It's like building a house in space.
Well, no, it's like building a football field coliseum in space. It's literally the size of two football fields, George.
With minimal tools.
With, well, yeah, and people, hands, you know, cranking wrenches,
just
and holding, you know.
Just a few people.
And they're spacesuited, and it's hard to work in a spacesuit, and you've got limitations on CO2 and oxygen and you know, puncturing the suit. Remember how after so many missions they had to start having the astronauts take about 5 minutes to examine their gloves?
Yeah, I mean, that's why it seems to be so remarkable. I don't know how they can do this.
Well, all that database, all that knowledge, you know, bank that we have created is now going to be focused on the next step, which is to go back out of low Earth orbit. And all we're missing, George, is the money. And it's that legacy that the moon, subsequent to the moon years, gave us, which was basically we did it, you know, if I can use a phrase, A backwards.
I bet the NASA budget gets slashed whenever we get this deficit spending program out.
And I bet it's going to be increased.
All right, you're on again.
Based on what we're going to talk about in the next 2 hours. Now, let me do a couple of things. Tonight is the 42nd anniversary. You know that one of the legendary names of the moon is Diana.
Mm-hmm.
I want to give a shout-out to Charlie Linville's wife, Diana, who is very, very ill in the Midwest, and I don't know what the forecast is going to be. But she's a faithful listener, and she is definitely part of our Coast family as well as my Facebook family. I mean, I've got like 25,000 people that are following me on Facebook, a lot of whom are tuning in tonight because they wanted to hear 2 hours of what we talk about. So to all those people, you know, all that crew of the Enterprise mission, welcome aboard and fasten your seatbelts because this is going to be a very interesting flight.
Not only that, I understand that you've been doing some peeking at the asteroid Vesta. You're still looking at Comet Elenine.
Yep.
Lots of strange things going on. I haven't heard you talk this way in a long, long time.
Well, I think we're poised on the brink of extraordinary things. And when you look around at the country, George, you know, there is a very serious problem, a systemic problem in our basic, the fabric of society and our economic structure. In all previous recessions, there's an economic website which has some really amazing graphs showing all the way back to the Depression of the 1930s what's happened when we've gone into a recession and how rapidly we bounced back. We have not bounced back from this 2008, 2007 recession, depression, whatever you want to call it, the worst since, you know, the Great Depression in the 1930s. And everybody's kind of fishing around and looking around and saying, what's gone wrong? What's gone wrong? When the government has done exactly what it did in every other recession, which worked. Well, I have a new answer tonight, and that is that we basically run out of our seed corn. We have been living over the last 40 years on the legacy of John Kennedy, on the economic and technological benefits of his vision of galvanizing the American enterprise to go to the moon and to create a myriad of stunning, unprecedented technologies that were required to do that, which had all kinds of economic and technological spin-offs back here on Earth. And I could spend the next hour citing all the economic studies that show that for every dollar NASA spent in Apollo, the country was like between 7 and 20 times richer by the end of the Apollo experience.
That's not happening now with the
space
program.
It's not happening now because we're not spending the equivalent amounts of money. What we're doing now is spending in constant dollars, because you have to take into account inflation, et cetera. We are spending like $1 billion in equivalent 1960s money on NASA, not the $18, $19 billion that you actually see in the registers, because of inflation, because of the decline of the dollar, because of the, you know, changes in the global economic picture. So we're not really keeping up with inflation in terms of what we're investing, and the culture and the society and the economy as a result are taking a real hit because we've eaten up our seed corn. We've used up all the technological doodads and miracles and gadgets and things that incredible expenditure of R&D bought us from the 60s through the 70s. And unless we do something equivalent again, the United States of America is going to become a banana republic, and other nations on this planet are going to take over the leadership of Earth. I'm thinking China, just exactly as what happened like Portugal and Spain in the, you know, 15th century.
We have gone from when Kennedy spoke, coming out of the Eisenhower era, where he warned the nation in Eisenhower's goodbye address to the country, warned the nation about the industrial military complex. Nobody, I think, understood that, Richard, at the time.
Well, they didn't, and there's a very pernicious aspect that Eisenhower was only touching on. I mean, everybody's looked at the political kind of overtones or undertones or subtext to what he was saying, which was warning of the concentration of power in that iron triangle, that triumvirate of, you know, military, contractors, politicians. But what he didn't really talk about was when you spend, you know, almost our defense budget now is almost $1 trillion a year. That's insane.
I know. And it'll probably go higher.
Spending all that money on defense, it's not creating or building anything for the society or the nation at large.
Are we spending it on defense or offense, Richard?
Well, you know, we do these wars. You know, we have a couple of these major conflicts now in the Middle East, Iraq, Afghanistan. But it is not productive. It doesn't employ people in consumer goods, in cutting-edge new technologies, in pushing back frontiers of knowledge, which create additional products and additional services that people can buy and be employed creating. In other words, it's basically a dead end. And the real dead end is the creation of huge stockpiles of weapons that, if they are ever used, you wind up destroying the planet. I mean, we have tonight 50,000 warheads sitting on missiles all over the world.
Yep.
That we cannot use, which are treasure.
Aimed everywhere,
but it's locked up because if it's used, we destroy civilization. So it's a lost leader. It makes certain people rich. The armaments industry, the aerospace contractors who actually get most of their money from the DOD and not from the NASA expenditures. If we were to spend the equivalent amount of money on NASA that we spend on the DOD, we would be living in the earthly equivalent of heaven, because the productivity and the technological revolutions that that kind of expenditure would basically buy us, using again the Kennedy Apollo model, which is now history. It's not that we have to imagine it or theorize. We can look back and say, this is what we spent, this is what we got, and this is what we're no longer getting because we're not doing the same thing. And if you don't do the same thing, you're not going to get the same result. We have to turn a page. We need a major game changer to expand this planet from a closed, limited system where we are pricing ourselves out of existence and we're borrowing so that the only guys who are benefiting are the bankers, to an open system where everybody can once again participate, which is what Kennedy imagined would happen. And then, of course, they killed him. And what he planned never came to fruition, so we run out of our seed corn. And unless we start doing something really imaginative again, the United States is on a long, steady decline to, as my friend Arthur Clarke used to say, the great primeval sea.
I would bet you that we are not going to do this creative endeavor.
Unless there is a game changer. And tonight I'm going to present the evidence of a coming game changer in two stages, phase one and phase two.
This game changer created by us or by something else?
No, created by something else. And it's like this, we have been building toward this where from a posture and position of concealing all the real extraordinary things that are out there in the solar system that we could have been benefiting from. Tonight, for the first time in my lifetime, and I say that very seriously, it's appearing as if NASA is actually telling us the truth about a brand new world it has encountered, i.e. this Dawn Vista, Vesta mission.
This asteroid?
This asteroid Vesta. Because Vesta, as my 19,000 Facebook people have been talking about for the last 2 weeks nonstop, has ruins on it. And they're so blatant and so obvious and so geometric that even people who previously could not see ruins on other places are saying, oh my God, I'm seeing right angles, I'm seeing walls, I'm seeing structure, I'm seeing shadows of buildings.
Now, wait a minute. If I remember, aren't you the Cydonia guy?
Yes, I sure am.
That's right. That's right. I remember you from a long time ago. So you are saying, we're going to get into this after the break, you are saying that this asteroid has artificial structures on it, or are you saying the asteroid itself is artificial?
Well, we don't know. I mean, the scale of things we're seeing is so big that at some level you could say we're looking at the structure of the body itself, that it may, in fact, be a humongous space station. Now, keep in mind the model that I've been talking about for the last several years. And we got, what, 3 or 4 minutes?
We have 2.5.
We have been quietly looking at ruins on these NASA images, also Russian imagery, European imagery from the European Space Agency. And we have been assembling this data into a model, which people like Joseph Farrell and I and many others have been discussing in terms of a potential ancient Type 2 civilization. Where does that term come from? Well, it actually comes from a Russian astronomer back in the 60s named Kardashev, and then it was freely borrowed by Michio Kaku when he used to do art show all the time. Kardashev basically chronicled that there should be, if we ever got to where we could encounter them or see evidence of them, three main celestial civilizations in the cosmos. Type 1, which control the energy of its planet.
Mm-hmm.
Type 2, which control the energy of its solar system, in other words, its entire star. And a Type 3, which control the energy of an entire galaxy of stars of hundreds of billions of suns or stars.
And we're Type 1.
We think we're looking now, because of the scale and amazing diversity and number of ruins we have found on this official data, we're looking at the remains of an ancient Type 2 civilization, which we have been growing up inside of all these years, all these decades, all these centuries, thousands of years. We've been surrounded by these structures and these other places that have this stuff on them, and we never knew because you can't see them with telescopes.
We will talk more about this and this game changer you're talking about on Coast to Coast AM. Just went back to my office during the break, Richard, and producer Tom, of course, back there, too. And he said, would you like to have President Obama on the show? And I went, what? And he said, yeah. And I said, yeah, if you could arrange that, we'll see what happens.
Okay.
If you had that ability, let's assume we had him on the program, and I got you on with us to talk about NASA for a little bit with him, what would you ask him?
Well, I'm asking him why he's not following the model that he ran on, and he basically began his administration on, to suddenly stop absolutely cold. And I can give you an exact date when whatever was being planned changed, and it changed radically.
A lot of things that he has done changed.
Yes. And I think it's because, as the head of the most powerful nation on Earth, Obama is in a very delicate position that basically he had to change course, shift gears, and go to a plan B because something was presented that was so threatening that unless we change course, very horrible things could have happened.
With regards to NASA or everything?
Everything. Remember, again, it's Farrell and my model that we are dealing with. A bunch of crazies out there.
Well, explain the model again to a lot of people who probably don't. Explain the Farrell-Hoagland model.
Dr. Joseph Farrell is a PhD from Oxford who has been working with me for the last several years. We've been writing books separately. We've been comparing models. We've been doing research that incredibly overlaps, even though we don't compare notes basically until after our stuff is published.
Mm-hmm.
And we both come to the conclusion, also people like Richard Dolan, you know, Dr. Dolan, who I'm going to be appearing in Leeds with a conference I'll talk about in a little while. We're all independently coming to the idea that World War II was a real, you know, high watermark in terms of human cultural development on this planet. And even though we think we won World War II and we beat the Nazis and they are no more, sorry, guys, but that's not quite true.
I agree with that.
There is substantive evidence that both on this planet and off this planet, the Nazi philosophy, the Nazi way of thinking, the whole fascistic idea of suborning people to a gross corporate exploitation culture is alive and well and living in our midst. And all you have to do is look at history from 40 years ago when Kennedy was killed to where we are tonight, and that trend curve is unmistakable and very, very deadly. And it was Obama who was going to, according to every piece of data I've been able to put together.
Gosh, Richard, you used to call him President Obama. Even you have changed.
No, because I'm using the colloquial.
All right.
He at the moment when he was going to begin to initiate certain major policies that would have turned this around. In fact, in one of his press conferences, the president actually used the metaphor of turning a great ship in the middle of the ocean around. Now, if that's not a metaphor for the Titanic, I don't know what it is, okay? And then suddenly something happened. And a lot of people on the left are very disappointed in President Obama because he hasn't done a number of the things that they assumed he was going to do that he'd run on.
That's true.
He's been trying to walk on eggshells and to keep it together, I believe, waiting for the appropriate time when this game changer could be revealed. And I can announce tonight that I'm seeing strong evidence that we are now in the middle of that process, or I should say at the beginning of that process, moving toward the middle because of things that NASA is doing.
Now, is this game changer Richard C. Hoagland speculation, or is there something you know?
Well, no, it has to do with data. Remember, I don't rely on inside sources. I detest inside sources because what are they going to do? They're going to lie to you.
Yeah, but you have them.
I have them, but I calibrate them against the objective data that can be measured and replicated and objectified in the way of other people looking at the same evidence and coming to the very similar conclusions. So what I'm seeing in the NASA data is a change of their game plan. Every other planet we've ever visited over the last 40 years, NASA has obscured and obfuscated the data, beginning with Mars, looking at the moon, looking at the outer planets, looking at Mercury, looking at everywhere we've had filtered data where you couldn't really put your finger on, for people who don't do this stuff for a living every day, the hard evidence that would convince your average skeptic, oh my God, there's something there. VESTA is different. The mission itself is named dawn. Do you remember the logo that Obama ran on during the campaign? Remember that spectacular kind of sunrise American flag combination?
Yeah, if I pulled it up, I'd recollect.
With the rays coming out and all that?
All right.
Well, that is representative symbolically of something called Horus, Horus of the horizon. It's a symbolic representation, George, of the dawn, like the dawn of a new age. This mission to Vesta is literally named Dawn, and I believe it is a cryptic reference to what it is going to do, which is to usher in a new age where we finally, after 40 years of marking time, of 30 years of going around and around and around with that magnificent machine, which is coming back in a couple of hours, we're finally going to break out of this treadmill and go and do something important, extraordinary, and will revolutionize the culture and the economy as a side effect of finally achieving what NASA was created to do.
Okay, how can a mission to an asteroid do all that and be such a game changer?
Well, as soon as we get close enough, and this is a very interesting mission because it's not like an ordinary unmanned planetary mission where you launch it on a rocket, it travels in coasting flight through space, it gets to a planet, it slows down with a rocket, goes into orbit, and then you take pictures. This vehicle, this amazing spacecraft, is actually powered by an ion engine. So it has been thrusting continuously for almost 1,000 days ever since it left orbit, Earth orbit, several years ago, in order to achieve rendezvous with this asteroid in the asteroid belt, which is technically very difficult to get to because of the orbit that it's in and the distance it is from Earth. It is now moving closer under ion thrust, achieving in the next few days a circular orbit almost 3,000 miles above this little 330-mile-wide asteroid. As it's been getting closer over the last several months, particularly in the last few weeks, NASA has been releasing, get this, George, one image per week. One image per week out of the thousands they've been taking. And it's obvious if you compare these images side by side by side, as we've been getting closer, and the cameras, of course, stay the same resolution, so it's the distance that you're closing which increases the ability to see things in the images. In the last couple images, the most amazing geometric structures have been appearing like out of the mists in these images. And I've, you know, been talking about them on my Facebook page with, you know, 19,000 plus friends and on other pages. And I've been looking at reactions and carefully looking at how people see this. Remember, this is not our interpretation. This is not our enhancements. These are NASA's raw data that we haven't touched. We haven't had anything to do with, except we're looking at it coming in from the space agency, and people are seeing structures all over Vesta. And what's interesting is they've only given us one side, George. Vesta is a little body, as I said, is about 300 miles across.
And it looks pretty round, doesn't it?
It's actually more geometric. If you actually start measuring, it's got straight edges like Iapetus.
But it doesn't look like a normal asteroid, which is generally a chunk of rock,
it's
right?
It's not a splinter. It's not a potato. It's roundish, but it's got geometry on it, even in the grossest scale, in terms of its cleavage, in terms of the sides. But as you get closer, you start seeing all kinds of geometric detail within that image, within the disk, within the surface of this object. And it's now getting so blatant. I was able to find an infrared image last night, which someone had put together with the visible light image. And you can see that the structures have different colors because they're different chemical composition than the background of the asteroid itself. It's looking like we're looking at a 300-mile-wide object, which was amazingly built on, and then over millions of years destroyed by meteor bombardment, but not as much as you might expect. So there's a lot in this infinitesimal gravity that is still left because there hasn't been the kind of piling on of dust that you have on the moon,
right,
where things get covered by downslope movement where they are basically buried. Here, if an object strikes, the escape velocity of the resulting particles takes them away from the asteroid and you wind up seeing the structure underneath. So there's excavation that's gone on, and there's all kinds of exhumed, partially buried, geometric things that nature simply can't produce, not only on the Earth, but certainly on an object that's 300 miles wide, which is the size of Connecticut. So the game changer comes here. As we get closer, as the pictures get better in resolution.
It also looks like a portion of this thing has been blown away.
Well, that's the NASA model. I'm wondering if, in fact, that's not a deliberate specific shape, because there is this huge thing that's being called a mountain at the South Pole that, in fact, some of the people that I've talked to on Facebook believe is actually a huge ruined pyramid. If it is, it is tens of miles on a side.
Well, it's huge.
And it's tens of miles high. And you got to think big, because if we are in the ruins of a Type 2 civilization, the cost and the ability to build things on this scale is completely different than our current view of technology and engineering and how you would do things if you were using human-level technology.
Well, and I've got to tell you, there's... There's a image on the left side of this asteroid that looks like, to me, like a head of an ape or a monkey.
Well, you have to be careful now of these anthropomorphic projections.
Have you seen that picture,
yeah,
though?
You can see faces in clouds.
Well, you've seen faces on Mars.
Remember, Carl, that's actually a structure because we've got a lot more data, and it's three-dimensional, and it's really there, and it's not just the random appearance of craters lit under a certain sun angle.
Which is what you think I'm looking at.
On Vesta.
On Vesta. Yeah,
I think that's not really real. The thing you want to look for is what Carl Sagan told us to look for 30 years ago. When Carl wrote his first book in 1971, he said in the book, and it was burned into my brain because it was like the latch key to the solar system. He said, intelligent life on Earth first manifests itself in the geometric regularity of its constructions. When they sent the first TIRO satellites, the first weather satellites back in the 60s into orbit, Carl went pouring through the pictures looking for evidence of civilization on Earth in those first primitive television pictures radioed down in the 60s from TIROs. And he found one example, which was a logging road in Canada where there had been a snowfall, and the snowfall had filled in the road, which went straight for miles and miles and miles, and the surrounding forests were dark, and the snow on the ground under the forest could not be seen. But in this road cleared through this forest, you could see this straight as an arrow for miles geometry, and that was evidence of a man-made structure visible with a primitive satellite in Earth orbit at the dawn of the space age. Well, now, of course, the cameras are infinitely better. They're CCD chips. They're not little television image orthicons or vidicon tubes. The latitude is incredible. The ability to, enhance imagery in computers on a desktop is almost infinite. You can bring out subtle shadings. You look at geometry, and geometry is king. You don't want to look for faces or things that are familiar like animals or people. You want to look for geometry because nature does not produce on this scale repeating regular geometry, and that's what we're seeing now all over this side of Vesta, which is astonishing, because at this distance we should not be seeing that unless the structures are gargantuan, built by an incredible Type 2 civilization, which means what's down there for Obama's first manned mission to an asteroid. Remember how he's been saying now, we got to visit an asteroid, we got to go to an asteroid?
Yep.
This is why.
Yep.
Asteroids will have preserved, unlike planets, the ruins of this ancient civilization, so we can basically walk in and take the technology off the shelves and bring it home and turn it into an economic and renaissance on this planet, the likes of which human beings have never seen in modern history. That's the plan.
If you think that's the plan, I bet even if they confiscated that kind of knowledge, Richard, they'd never share it with us.
Why then are they showing us the pictures? Well, remember, the worst thing you can do is a futurist.
They have to show us the
pictures. No, they don't.
They got to say something.
No. Come on. NASA's been jiggling pictures and making up data for decades.
Well, let me ask you this. If there are artificial structures there, somebody built them, this Type 2 civilization that you say, where'd they go? Why would you build structures on an asteroid that is zooming throughout the solar system? It doesn't have any regular pattern to it or anything.
Vesta is in orbit around the sun, just like the other asteroids, just like the Earth, like the planets. If you're trying to imagine what this civilization looked like in its heyday, it's kind of hard because all we see now are ruins. Farrell and I, again, independently, came to the conclusion, in fact, Tom Van Flandern, my late friend Tom Van Flandern, who I so wish was now around to see this.
Oh, what a time this would have been for him.
Oh, he would absolutely have joy at what's going on, because he has been talking for many, many years about a missing planet in the asteroid belt called Planet 5, remember?
Well, that's right. And I was going to ask you, is this Planet X, Vesta?
Well, it's a remnant, maybe, of a moon that used to orbit Planet 4, and that was blown up in Tom's model. And Tom and I used to argue, was it natural? Was it the physics inside the planet? Because you can't really go to your average physicist these days and say, okay, give me a prescription how to blow a planet up. They don't know how. There's no energy source in the universe big enough under conventional physics to blow a planet to kingdom come.
But planets blow up.
Well, we know of at least one in our own backyard that did, and that's where you have to invoke the hyperdimensional torsion field model, because there is more than enough energy if you somehow harness it, either naturally through the bad luck of being the wrong place at the wrong time, or deliberately with a technology in a great war. So Farrell and I have independently come to the conclusion that what destroyed Tom's planet, his missing planet, was in fact an incredible war. That this Type 2 civilization, either because of an outside threat or because of an internal civil conflict that got out of hand. I mean, remember back, you know, in history, back when we were developing nuclear weapons, when the first atomic bomb here in New Mexico in 1945 was detonated just a few miles south of me, and the physicists were actually arguing, if we touch this thing off, will we ignite the atmosphere?
That's right.
And destroy the Earth?
Yes, they actually thought that was a possibility.
And they did it anyway.
Yeah. They did it because one mathematician had a model that said, highly unlikely, but possible.
Yeah, but they bet the farm.
They bet the
on
farm.
On a mathematical. Or suppose these guys,
we're
these
wrong.
Ancient guys, who were basically us in a reincarnation, you know, eons ago, were as stupid as we were. Suppose they did something that got out of hand. Let's say that they were doing something to probe the energy interior of this planet, and it got out of hand, and they wound up blowing the place to kingdom come. Same result, because when you dustify, to use, you know, Dr. Wood's expression for what happened to the World Trade Centers, when you dustify with this kind of technology, which is why I got into that whole 9/11 scenario to look at the potential for the technology in front of us in the way of evidence, when you get into it, you can destroy entire worlds if you do this inadvertently or if you do it deliberately in a war. And Joseph and I think that either by accident or design, somebody made one hell of a mistake and they wound up destroying this incredible Type 2 civilization, and we're living in the ruins. And the problem then is to find those ruins that are the least ruined so you can go back and look at them and get evidence and hopefully get technology that will give our civilization the huge leg up it needs in the way of energy, in the way of productivity, in the way of liberating 6 billion human beings, so we don't have to depend on fossil fuels, but you do it in a way that you don't wind up blowing our civilization apart.
I want to find out your scenario when we come back, Richard, get your take on the comet that's coming close by, and more. Final Hour with Richard C. Hoagland on Coast to Coast AM.